Be seated. Welcome. All right, the first matter we have on calendar today is docket number 66565, Pettit versus Andrew Zazian. I'm sure I butchered that, but I'm sure you'll correct me. So, counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, if you'd like to come up.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, my name is Talia Williams, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Pettit. I would like to reserve approximately 6 minutes for response, if I may.
Yes.
May it please the court. In the 1800s, Lucy Stone made history because she retained her maiden name and attempted to register property in it. No state in the union allowed her to register her own name because at the time of marriage, a woman's status changed. 115 years later, we have Wallace v. Forbush, in which Wendy Forbush attempted to get a driver's license in her maiden name, which she also retained after marriage. But the United States Supreme Court affirmed that a woman upon marriage had a different legal identity, and she had to get her legal documents, including a driver's license, in her husband's name. Fast forward to 2015, and we have the Obergefell case, which famously made same-sex marriage available. Same-sex couples could marry the same as heterosexual couples. But what may not have been as famous in the headlines was that the Supreme Court affirmed the abolishment of couverture. Couverture was the common law traditional concept that a married woman's status changed upon getting married. A single woman had certain rights that a married woman wouldn't have. Here we are now, 2016, and we still have a statute, NRS 440.286C, which unequivocally states that an unmarried woman, upon having a baby, can unilaterally decide whether to give the newborn her own last name as the child's surname or the child's father's last name, assuming paternity has been established. The law is completely silent as to a married woman's ability to do the same, leading the reasonable citizen and reader of the statute to assume she cannot.
Counsel, do we even need to reach the statute in this particular case?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Do we need to even reach the statute in this case?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor, and is one that I've struggled with since I've written the brief, and I think we do, and this is the reason. I think that statute predetermined the outcome in this case. That is because in Maggiera v. Luera, the 1990 case that this court decided, as well as Russo v. Gardner 8 years later, it was presumed that a child's name on a birth certificate should be accorded some respect and finality. And that is the reason that the Supreme Court decided that the only way you could change that name was with clear and compelling evidence.
Well, let's come back. You talked about this is a situation where the mother of the child, and at the time, even though there were some marriage difficulties, this was a marriage. And the child was born within wedlock, not outside. So certain presumptions that we normally deal with change in terms of paternity and so on. There's no dispute as to paternity or anything else. So the issue before the court in this particular sense, even though you're going back even deeper, is whether a name change is appropriate and as the court parsed out that reflects both parents' interests because it took two people to create the child.
Correct. Your Honor, respectfully, I would say treating unmarried women differently than married women.
Well, let's not look at unmarried women as much as let's look at the child, the best interest of the child.
And I think that shows, Your Honor, respectfully, that that statute really has a really strong presumption over how we think about these issues. The district court itself said this marriage was technically a marriage. The couples never lived together. They were married for a month. Ms. Pettit never took on Mr. Adrianson's name. And the child is not harmed by having just Pettit as his last name. It would be kind of constitutionally problematic to say that A child who's born of a married woman versus an unmarried woman could never have his mother's surname alone. And that's exactly what the case really is.
So was it predetermined that the father wasn't going to have any reasonable visitation or any interaction with the child or be able to be involved in this child's life?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court held in favor of Ms. Pettit that she'd have primary custody. So Mr. Adrianzen would have visitation. And I don't think all the case law that is out there says that whether or not the child's relationship with the father is strong or not is not really the question. The question really is we have a constitutional issue and we have best interests. The constitutional issue is whether or not it's okay for a married woman or a woman in general to be able to give her child her last name alone.
Well, counsel, it strikes me because we're almost treating the child as if they're chattel, and that kind of bothers me. The child is the product of two individuals who there's no dispute as to acknowledging how this child was created. So we're down to this issue of whether we should have one name or the other or the hyphenated name and long-term best interest of this child because we had a newborn at the time. And trying to look at it in that light of potentially long-term best interest of the child.
And Your Honor, respectfully, I would say every time a child is named and only receives the father's surname, it's not saying he's not identified with his mother.
Well, that's not necessarily the case that we have in terms of just taking the mother's surname out of the equation. We have a hyphenated situation we wound up with. But having said that, do you have any argument as to compelling interest versus preponderance?
Yes. As far as the evidence goes in this case, the evidentiary hearing did not actually have evidence. At the end of the case, counsel argued. The district court invited counsel to have any last-minute argument on the name change, which hadn't really been dealt with in the entire case. At that point, counsel argued Mr. Adrianzen would like to have the child have his name. Ms. Pettit would like to have the child have his name. And in the Solomonic decision, it's best just let's give the child both names. I have a difficulty pronouncing both names together. I do think it's awkward. Even the appellee's brief law review article says that on page 8 of this article regarding Latino surnames that in the United States, hyphenated names often are deemed awkward and odd. Now,
ask you this. There was some testimony and there was some back and forth with counsel and Mr. Adrianzen, and his concern, and he was asked specifically why it was important to him to have his name as part of the surname, and he said it's important to him because of his culture, and he'd like to have his son know where he comes from. And when asked further about his culture, he said he's Hispanic, and in Hispanic families, usually most children have their father's last name, first name, and their mother's second.
Somewhat.
And so it's not correct that there wasn't any testimony as to what was the best interest of the child and why the why the controversy exists in this case.
I think I misspoke. In the case in chief, in the case that was presented to the court, there wasn't any evidence. But again, at the end, after counsel had spoken, the district court then invited the actual litigants to say something. I would say, though, that Mr. Adrianzen did not seek to have a hyphenated name. He did not seek in terms of, as a Latino, I'd like to have my child.
Nobody, he put on the record why it was important that to him and to his culture that the child reflect his name and his culture as well.
Well, 162 and 163 of the record, in response to the court's question, he says, yes, in Hispanic families, usually most children have their father's last name first and their mother's second.
But very interestingly, he did not actually seek that.
Well, he may not have.
Right.
But I appreciate your advocacy on behalf of your client, the mother. But in the case of a married couple, which they are, notwithstanding your efforts in the brief to suggest that it's a strained relationship and so forth, we can't ignore the fact that they're a married couple. The mom, you advocate, should have a say-so in the name. So should dad, shouldn't he? And when they can't agree, which was the case here, then what is left to do? The courts are to resolve that dispute, right?
Yes.
And isn't aren't the treatises pretty overwhelming that the burden of proof is consistent with Maggiera, and it suggests a series of factors that the district courts are supposed to evaluate in determining the name?
I would say clear and compelling evidence would be a very high standard in a civil case. And I don't think saying that it's in my interest, because I'd like the child to reflect something that is important to my heritage, who will not have primary custody of the child, would actually meet that high burden.
But doesn't Maggiera suggest a preponderance of the evidence?
It does not. Maggiera very clearly states that the person seeking a name change bears the burden, which burden was not placed on Mr. Adriansen. The burden was placed on both of them to show why. But Maggiera is very clear. The burden is on the person seeking to change the name on a child's birth certificate by clear and compelling evidence. Clear and compelling, I interpret as clear and convincing, which is a very high standard in civil law.
And don't the cases that Maggiera relied on, are those distinguishable, and should that be good law today?
I don't think so. In my brief, you'll see that I cite numerous cases across the country that have taken up this issue, who have stated that, one, despite how it might sound somewhat churlish, that in fact a woman has a constitutional right to see her child's surname. Now, whether that's in the best interest of the child is another matter. That's the second inquiry. But first, that we can't presume that because two people made the child, that women are not able to enjoy the same benefits that men have to have the child just bear their name. In this case, the child did have already a name, and our statute says that if she were unmarried, that would be fine, but she wasn't. And in fact, the legislature has really showed an effort to change that. In NRS 125C, my understanding is that is being recodified to take away the distinction between married couples and unmarried couples in the custody of their children.
You said that the child already had a name. My understanding was that from the very beginning there was a dispute as to whether or not the child would bear the mother's name, the father's name, and that wasn't resolved.
I don't see that in the record, respectfully, Your Honor, but from what I glean implied in Maggiera and Russo.
No, I'm talking about the facts of this case.
Oh, at no point was there any agreement as to the name.
No, they
that
couldn't
is true.
Agree.
But when Ms. Pettit left the hospital and she did not have Mr. Adriansen there at the time, she put the name on the birth certificate as she deemed fit. Which is
okay.
What happened.
You've answered my question.
Okay.
We're chewing into your rebuttal time.
I know. Ms. Williams, can I ask you a question, a quick one, please? You referred to this as like a Solomon-like decision. I thought of that in preparing for the case today. With that in mind, the standard review is whether the judge abused his discretion here in doing this. How can you say he abused his discretion for all the treatises, things that Justice Hardesty mentioned, and others? Isn't that kind of the judge's call if it's not, the law is not clear on that particular point?
I would say it's for two reasons. One, if a judge misapplies the standard, then it's ipso facto that he has abused his discretion. And it does not appear that the judge did use the right standard. He did not say that Mr. Adriansen had the burden of proving by clear and compelling evidence that the child's name should be changed. And secondly, I would say, again, the thrust of all the case law at this time in the last 20 years has been to say that there is no harm to a child to have his mother's name, and particularly so when that mother has been granted primary custody, as was here, and the court itself acknowledged that the marriage only lasted 1 month and they never lived together.
Okay. Colleagues, anything else? What I'm going to do, we really did chew into your time, so I'm going to give you 3 minutes in addition, and I'll grant opposing counsel 3 minutes as well.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Perry Gary, Justices. May it please the court. Excuse me, my name is Shannon Weinstead, representing Kevin Adrianzen today at this proceeding. I'd like to first go directly to Justice Douglas's comments out of the box was, do we get to the constitutionality of NRS 440 in this case? And the answer to that question is no. It was not referenced by the district court at the time that the decision was made, and there is nothing in the court's decision that suggests that that statute made the court determine that a father has any more right to naming the child than does the mother.
Let me pause you right there. As I understand your opponent's position, but for the fact that these people were legally married, this would not be an issue because under that statute, the mother could have given the child her name, and it would have been unexceptionable and not able to be litigated. Is that fair?
That's a fair assessment, but I'm not sure. I don't necessarily.
So this case only exists by virtue of the fact they were married, right?
No. I don't think that's the case.
So if you had two unmarried people who have a child, same exact facts as this one, except for that they were never married, what would your client's ability be to have contested the mother giving the child her surname?
The same exact procedural vehicles that he used in this case.
But would it come out the same under the statute? I think that's your point.
I apologize, Your Honor. I believe that it would. I do believe that it would because the legislature in 2015
But for the 2015 equalizing married and unmarried, it would not have, correct?
No, I think that when once, and that's the problem with Majera, once the father, whether he's unmarried or not, seeks the court's involvement in this dispute, then the court has to look at what is in the best interest of the child, and Majera imposes a clear and convincing evidence standard, and that's part of part B of our argument, is that that unfortunately creates an unfair advantage in whoever gets to the vital statistics first. Typically, that's the mother of the child.
Well, but there's case law out there that it could remain an initial naming dispute. And you would distinguish Maggiero by saying this is an initial naming dispute rather than a change of name. I understand that. You want us to overrule Maggiero, though.
Yes, we would. And I'd also.
And what showing do you make that Maggiero is totally unworkable and the other types of standards for stare decisis and when you're going to depart from established precedent?
With Maggiero, Justice Pickering, Maggiero, there's a factual distinction that we're dealing with. In Maggiero, the court did the right thing because you had a father that for 3 years had no visitation, only came to court when he was asked to pay more child support. And then he said, well, I want to change the child's name. And then the district court.
So your point is you'd like to distinguish Maggiero rather than overrule it. Is that right?
Well, I think under the facts, and Maggiero was 25 years ago, I think things have changed. As Ms. Williams pointed out in her opening, the family has changed. The law, statutory law, has changed. I think Maggiero is overly restrictive on this issue, and I think it deprives the district courts from doing what's in the best interest of the child. And so yes, I think it's distinguishable on the facts, but I also think that the clear and convincing hurdle is inconsistent with other laws, and it's also puts.
But we don't get to change precedent just because we think there's a better rule. There has to be some showing it's totally unworkable, and so on. So I'm trying to elicit from you, to the extent you want us to overrule Maggiero, on what grounds should we do so?
Okay, I would say, Your Honor, when the courts establish clear and convincing evidence burdens. They're doing it in cases of fraud where there's a chance of deception, or they're doing it to disfavor a certain type of claim. And so if you're looking to try to disfavor a parent who's been excluded from naming the child from coming into court to rectify that situation, I think that that is not, I don't think that in great respect is the proper law, especially under this situation. I think a preponderance of the evidence standard has been placed in the hands of the family courts for years, and they make more significant sometimes, more significant decisions on a preponderance of evidence standard. They allow children to move internationally or relocate only on a preponderance of an evidence standard. And I don't see why this court should put a name change as a create that higher standard. I see what the court had done 25 years ago in Majera because they didn't like the idea of fathers coming back years and years later to somehow establish their, as the district court in that case called it, their a tangible benefit for paying child support.
Yeah, and see, I think Majera is defensibly decided on a true years have passed, the kid's gone under that name forever, et cetera. So it's almost, it's easier for me to distinguish Majera than overrule it outright.
Well, ultimately, that would be this court's decision on how to deal with it. But I do think, regardless of whether it's completely overruled, or the court carves out an exemption like we have here, where only the child was weeks old when the father went to the court to rectify a situation.
Counsel, is a clear and convincing burden of proof, whether applied against the father or applied against the mother, inconsistent with the evolution of family law in this state and the numerous statutory attempts to equalize the relationship of the parties?
Justice Hardy, I would absolutely agree with that comment, especially since 2015, where the legislature says, and this is very, this statute, 125C0015 says, a parent and child relationship extends equally to every child and to every parent, regardless of the marital status of the parents.
Well, that evolution began long before that, when the legislature began insisting on equal parenting opportunities, joint custody. That's something that's been developing over the past decade plus.
I would agree, and I think that this case provides this court with the opportunity to bring Majera in line with the current statutes and with the current concept of family as we know it. I mean, the family concept has changed drastically since Majera was first handed down by this court.
Could you address the hyphenation issue? Your opponent makes the comment in her brief that she found no cases that upheld hyphenation as an ideal solution or even an appropriate one when it was judge-imposed rather than party-originated. Is that true or false? And if there are cases that say that's a good thing, do you have citations to them?
I do not, as you asked me right now, Your Honor, have citations whether hyphenation is appropriate or not, but we did cite to a reference in our answering brief that hyphenation would be an option. And when you've got a situation in this particular case, which the district court found that the mother's expectations regarding the father's involvement in this case was according to the court, completely unreasonable. She was excluding the child.
I don't think the court found that. He awarded primary custody.
Well, he did, but her expectations going in, according to the court, her expectations of what visitation, what involvement this child should have, according to the court, in the court's words, was completely unreasonable. And so when the court made its decision to hyphenate the name, the court specifically, especially in this case where you've got issues with co-parenting and you've got parents at odds with each other, that a hyphenation, although Salmonic in nature, still actually does the right thing in terms of making sure that child identifies each side of the family. And I think in particularly in the facts of this case, that was the right decision for the district court to come to.
But not under Maggiore. It would take an amendment to Maggiore to, or an overruling of it.
Well, when you go to Maggiore, what would happen is that you would put the, I don't think Maggiore decides how, it indicates how the court should resolve the issue. What the court in Maggiore specifically did say is that a father has no greater right than the mother to have the child carry his namesake. The converse to that is equally true. A mother has no greater right than a father to carry the namesake. So if the parties can't agree and a hyphenation appears to be in the child's best interest, as it appeared to the district court in this case, then that would be the appropriate decision. There may be under, and we proposed in our answering brief, how the sister state courts have struggled with this issue. It's a hard issue for the courts to deal with, but there's a number of factors that the courts can consider. And so if the courts...
But here, the problem I have a bit is if we were to credit your argument and say Maggiore overstates the burden of proof, it shouldn't be this high, and particularly not when it's sort of an initial naming dispute as opposed to a name change years down the road, wouldn't we need to reverse and remand for application of the identified factors? Because on this record, all we have is the very... After the evidence is done, we have an exchange between the judge and one of the parties that's very, very brief. We don't really have testimony on the factors that you're now alluding to. So wouldn't we have to reverse and remand?
Not necessarily, Justice Pickering, because some of those factors were inherent within the court's decision. For example, one of the factors that is considered is the length of the time that the child has had the surname. And in this case, the court specifically found that the child had only had the surname for a couple months. Another one is whether how the surname will affect the child's identity in the household. The court specifically found that in this particular case, having sharing surnames from both parents would be in the child's best interest, given how this case is presented, was presented to the district court.
Would you agree that if we adhered strictly to Maggiore, we would have to reverse outright?
Not necessarily, because I believe, Your Honor, that the district court did consider the best interest of the child and the evidence that it relied upon in entering this decision was not refuted by the mother.
But if your client had the clear and convincing evidence burden, which you contest the appropriateness, and I understand that, what clear and convincing evidence was there that this court should do what it did?
That supports what the district court did in this case, what clear and convincing evidence? Is that the question, mm-hmm. Your Honor? It comes with what the court said when it says, especially the court...
What evidence is what I'm asking?
The evidence is the way this came... The evidence is...
The clear and convincing evidence.
The clear and convincing evidence is the mother was systematically depriving the father of a role in the child's life to the point that the court made note of it in its findings that in this case, the child should bear both names. That's the clear and convincing evidence. That seems to be what drove the court, and I think that is sufficient for the court to uphold that decision that the district court made, because it did consider these issues. Granted, the court did not say I'm using a clear and convincing evidence standard and this evidence is clear and convincing, but nor did the court say that I'm using preponderance of the evidence.
Was the evidence clear and convincing that the child had only had the surname for 2 months?
Absolutely.
Was the evidence clear and convincing that given the age of the child, it wasn't likely to create insecurity or confusion?
Absolutely.
I mean, all of that evidence was present in the record.
Yes, it was present. It was almost present in the way the case came to the court, that the child was merely a child that the parents are at odds, and the father's ability to participate in the decision-making process was completely unilaterally disposed of by what the mother did.
Did the mother offer any evidence that changing the name or hyphenating the name would create embarrassment, discomfort, or inconvenience to her as the custodial parent?
No, she did not Justice Hardesty.
Didn't the judge, in fact, consider a number of factors in the decision, and he set them out? For example, because of their estranged status, the child was in the hospital, and the father had little or no opportunity to have any say in how the child was named as he came out of the hospital, that your client had filed the action within 2 months of the birth of the child, and this persuaded the court that the best interest would be served. And this is something that struck me in particular, especially in this case. So it's not as if he didn't put a lot of thought into this. He looked at least to me, the appropriateness in this particular case, and made particular findings. So it wasn't one of those cases where he just decided, okay, let's split the baby, so to speak, and we're going to hyphenate the name. There was a lot of thought that went into this that I see.
And I would agree, Justice Perigary, that is absolutely true. There was a lot of thought that went into it by the district court. And what did not, and it's also important for the court to consider what did not go into it, and what did not go into it was the fact that the father had any more right than the mother to have his name inserted. That was not at any part of the proceeding in the lower court, nor is it part of any of our argument here today. And if I may, with just the remaining time that I have, again, reference the fact that the law, both decisionally, nationally, and statutorily in Nevada, has changed. And the important thing that I would like to make clear is that fathers and mothers, regardless of their marital status, all have a right to participate in the naming of their child. And if Majera stands in the way it's written now, what that allows is for the first person to get to the Department of Vital Statistics, it gives that person an opportunity to stand behind a heightened burden of proof without the best interest of the child ever being considered in the decision-making process. And again, I would submit to the court that this is a perfect opportunity for the court to revamp a case authority that's been in existence for now 25 years in light of all of the massive changes that have taken place in the domestic relations law of this state and the country. And with that, I'll give back the 25 seconds that I have left. Thank you. Thank you, Justice.
Colleagues, any other questions?
Unless there's more questions.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Williams, you got about 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to, first of all, point out what my opponent said in closing. Whoever gets to vital statistics first. I think that's exactly what the legislature had in mind. That's the reason that unmarried women who even have paternity established can either put their own surname or the father's surname. The only difference is that married women cannot.
Counsel, isn't it the case that NRS 440.2806C was not argued or raised by your client below?
That is correct, except it is absolutely presumed and implied in Majera. In Majera, it was not a changing of the name. It was the initial name. It was still a baby. It had been 3 years till it got to the point of getting to the court. That is the reason
Under what basis should the court consider your argument about the statute when it was not presented to the district court below?
Because, as we've heard already, the actual tenor of my opponent's argument is that Paige did something wrong. She systematically tried to exclude the father, and that was including the name. She kept him from the name. She didn't let him have a participation in the name. The only reason her conduct can be in any way seen as improper is because the statute doesn't permit her to put her last name on that birth certificate. And that is a predetermining statutory framework for this argument, and it was absolutely implied by Maggiera and Russo. Both of those cases seem to disagree with my opponent.
Counsel, with the argument that you're offering today, would it then be appropriate that when the mother's in labor giving birth, the father's sitting there at vital records having his last name entered? Is that what you're advocating? Erase?
I would not. I don't think that's what the statute says.
Is that what you're advocating?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. The statute says the woman does it. Initially, at least, she does. The woman who gives birth initially does. Afterwards, there can be a contest regarding it, and that contest has to be presented with clear and compelling evidence. I think the same would be true if there were two women who had a child. Now that same-sex marriage is available, or two men. Whoever puts that name there first, that is presumed to be true, the person giving birth. I think the legislature intended that. I mean, certainly Maggiera kept that in mind.
How would you do that with two men, though? I mean, not, since they don't give birth, I mean, how,
no.
How would... thinking about that situation, isn't that a race to, like Justice Douglas said,
I don't race think it to is, what? Because a woman will still have to, until we have artificial wombs, a woman is giving birth in that hospital. Now, she may have had some kind of contract with the two fathers.
But if she's a surrogate, it'd be the two same-sex couple would be the parents.
She may be contracted to put down one of the father's names. Right. But whatever she puts down, I think the Office of Vital Statistics is quite clear that the woman who gives birth puts that initial name down. And any changes, Maggiera and Russo say, must be by clear and compelling evidence. Now, it may be easy to make that bar if a surrogate puts her own name down for the child's surname, when in fact the child would be taken care of by two fathers. But that would be a clear and convincing standard.
But having said that,
I am trying to ask a question here.
Oh, sorry.
Did your opponent raise the claim in district court that Maggiera should be overruled?
Did my opponent do that?
Did
no.
He? Yes.
No.
So by the same token as your statute was not raised,
right.
neither did he.
Was raised, only at the appellate level.
Thank you.
We have a strong presumption in Nevada dealing with the child's best interest. How does that factor into this particular case?
Every court that I've looked at, and I've looked at plenty of them, as you can see from my table of authorities, that had a primary custodian.
I'm talking about the child's best interest,
right. Found
which changes the game somewhat. As the state of Nevada, in everything we do in the family law arena, we have to come back to, quote, the child's best interest.
It looks like my time is over. If I could just address that
question.
Please
answer his question.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. I do believe that every single case I looked at did, in fact, make paramount the child's best interest. It didn't ignore the constitutional right of a mom to have the child reflect her surname alone, but always paramount was the child's best interest. And every case felt that of primary importance was if that person had custody of the child, because that's the person who will register the child in school, that's the person with whom the child would have most social contact. In this case, you have a child's name that's not shared by anyone else in his family, and in fact can be an embarrassment to him. And in this case...
But he's got two sides to this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate
and,
that.
Yes.
I appreciate
so
that. I appreciate that, but other courts looking at it did feel that could be a way of standing out. Today, kids often don't want to stand out, and he's most of the time, he just has weekends with his father. Most
also,
of the time.
We don't know at this point because of the age of this child, which you're...
Right. The child at the time, actually, I recall the child was 2 years old at the time of the evidentiary hearing, not a few weeks old at all. That is not in the record. The child, I was not part of the case, but in fact, I was following it. And the child was already about a year and a half. In Maggiera, the child was 3 years old. In no case had they gone to school yet or established a public identity with the name. That's why it's very much an initial designation and not a change name. I thank you so much. This is my first time before you, so I appreciate
you. We appreciate you being here, and hope we didn't scare you off.
No,
and I would like to thank both lawyers on both sides for doing a very good job with the briefing. It's hard to pick up a case that you didn't handle in the trial court, and I appreciate the work both of you put in.
Thank you so much, Justice Quicker. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you both very much. This matter will stand submitted.